You are listening to the Pragmatic Christian Podcast with your host, Hayden Bruce.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Pragmatic Christian Podcast. If you're an old listener of the show, welcome back after a little bit of a hiatus. And if you're new, welcome to you as well. I think you are both going to enjoy this episode where I talk to Jared Bias. He is the co-host of the Bible for Normal People podcast with Peter Enns. And he's also the co-author with Pete Enns of Genesis for Normal People. And he has books forthcoming. I'll have links to some of Jared's work in the show notes, links to their podcast. Season 3 just released for their show. I think you guys will really enjoy it. And I think you'll really enjoy this interview that I had with Jared. We get into a whole range of topics, his background, his experience in fundamental Christianity, and then slowly progressing out of that. We talk about what it means for the Bible to be true, how to take the Bible seriously but not literally. We talk about philosophy, postmodernism, and practical advice for progressive Christians who don't know what to do and where to find community. We talk about a lot of different things, and I think you guys will really enjoy this episode. But you guys are going to hear about all of that in the episode, so without any further ado, here's my conversation with Jared Bias. I know that you are a Christian. I guess I can't really presume too much, but is that a lifelong thing? Did you grow up in the church? Like, where did you become afflicted with the Christian identity?
Yeah, so I did grow up as a Christian. I grew up in Texas, where you're kind of born as a Christian. It's just as much a cultural thing as it is a religious thing. So grew up in Texas as a Southern Baptist and Charismatic and eventually Presbyterian. And then I was a pastor at a Southern Methodist church, so I ran the gamut of many, many denominations, many iterations. So
you grew up a charismatic Southern Baptist? How does that work exactly?
Well, I was sandwiched between them. So my dad would have been Southern Baptist, my mom would have been charismatic. So I didn't go to a charismatic Southern Baptist church. I dabbled in both, depending on the Sunday, the year, the month. So
was there a tension in how, do you have any siblings, by the way?
I have an older sister.
Was there any tension in how to raise you guys with those two different worldviews? I just know that my best friend growing up was a Southern Baptist, and I grew up in the Assemblies of God, Pentecostal persuasion. So we had lots of debates. So I can't even imagine if him and I were partners trying to raise kids.
Well, you know, I think there, you know, again, the cultural aspect of that is important because for a lot of people, my parents weren't intellectuals. They didn't intellectualize their faith. It was a practical thing. So there wasn't a lot of debate, or there wasn't really any introduction of the idea of theology or really belief sets or doctrines. It was sort of very practical. And if anything, it was political more so. And that was kind of a practical way of you know, expressing your faith. And in Texas, that basically meant you were Republican. It didn't matter if you were Assemblies of God or Charismatic or whatever it was politically very vanilla and standard. So
And how did you get involved or interested in theology? Was that early on or was that later on? Your family didn't
Early on. I had a few friends in high school actually who were really connected to the Reformed Church and interested in presuppositional apologetics, which required some philosophy and some theology and a lot of different aspects. So I got heavily into that. I used to order my kids will never know this, but they were like catalogs where you could order cassette tapes of like major thinkers who were recorded at conferences or lectures. Yeah. So Dr. Greg Bahnsen or Cornelius Van Til. And I would just order all these tapes and then I would listen to them in my room at night and take notes and try to understand all these things. So that's really my introduction to any sort of theology or philosophy. And through that, just was introduced to a lot of different thinkers and changed my mind on a lot of different things through that. And then I went to Liberty University and was a philosophy major. So that's where Liberty, philosophy is housed in the School of Religion. So it's really this philosophical theology and theological philosophy. So they're really intertwined. Mm-hmm. So just introduced them that way through for a lot of things. Yeah.
And was your education into theology, philosophy presuppositional, or is that where you got exposed to a wider variety of persuasions?
I would have been introduced to a wider variety, but I would have personally probably still identified with that reformed, not only reformed, but more philosophically minded presuppositional apologetics all the way up until I went to graduate school. So that would have been when my mind would have really shifted away from that and toward biblical studies. And then once I wasn't anchored in the systematic house of cards, so to speak, I was free, I felt like, to explore all these other things that I had learned, but I had learned were bad and not good ways of thinking. And I started bringing those back to mind, thinking, oh, well, actually, there's some really good stuff there.
So, yeah. What was that transition like? Was that rough or was it natural?
It was probably, I don't know if those are opposed, probably natural and rough.
Yeah.
It's how I'm built. I think I'm always pushing the boundaries of thinking and concepts. So that felt natural to me, where I feel like within any boxed theology or doctrine, when you have certain dogma you have to believe, I don't do well with authority. I don't do well with kind of, once you figure it out, there's nothing left to figure out. So I'm very curious. I'm always pushing the bounds of things. So in that way, it was natural, but also rough, because I was a pastor. So my paycheck depended on me not changing my mind about some of these things.
Yeah. Yeah, I can imagine that being kind of rough, just for the fact that, you know, that kind of presuppositionalism is kind of based or founded on authority and boxes, and you don't really go outside those boxes. And so it's ironic that you took on so personally this this framework, this way of doing, you know, of thinking and doing theology, when your personal, you know, when your personality was so opposite of that.
Well, I also, though, I like control. Mm. And there's one thing about Reformed theology is it crosses all the T's, it dots all the I's. And if you want a system where you can control it, it's laid out for you. It's just a matter of memorizing and getting through it, which fit my learning style. I was really good at reading lots of volumes of things, thinking very analytically and linearly, and memorizing how do you get from point A to point B to point C. And if there's anything to be said for Reformed theology, I think they took on Enlightenment thinking to a great degree, and they're at least very consistent with it. And in that way, I appreciated that. You know, it is a consistent system of thought, which has, you know, there's some merit to that. So,
And about what, you know, time frame did that start to shift?
Yeah, that would have been while I was at Westminster Seminary, and I switched over to the Biblical Studies Department, and I started to see that this system of theology, while it was very consistent, and it was had a strong foundation, it was built on the Bible, which itself wasn't that systematic.
Right.
It wasn't. So it's almost sort of a, you know, building a house upon the sand, to use the old Sunday school song. The wise man builds his house upon the rock. Well, what happens if the Bible is the sandy part? And we're kind of building it on a rock because we need rock. We feel the need for that security and safety, and we want to make sense of the chaos. And the Bible is just messier than that. And that became real to me. And then that felt freeing, actually, for me. And probably good for my personality, as someone who likes to be in control and then have a Bible that it's really hard to make sense of, or a system of theology or his way of thinking, where I finally admitted to myself, well, I'm inconsistent. I think we're all inconsistent in our beliefs and in our ethics. And yeah, that became more energizing to me.
Yeah, yeah, I can relate. I went to Bible college to become a pastor and then a missionary. And during my time there, which I feel really lucky, because I feel like not a lot of people have this experience, but my school was kind of a new branch of an existing AG school, so they were a little bit more experimental. And the people that came on as professors were all like volunteers, you know, for this vision of a new school. And so they had all these professors with, you know, very different theologies, like specific theologies. Like, they're all in the same umbrella of belief, but they differed on like specifics. And so, like, that was the first time where I saw very smart people disagreeing on fundamental truths in my mind. And I was like, oh, wait, like, this is okay. And with my, you know, I feel kind of similar to you and your personality. I very much have always like rubbed against authority. I've always pushed the boundaries and stuff. And so, but I also like the control of my theology growing up, so I can relate there too. But then when I saw that modeled for me by the different professors, I took on to that very quickly and was like, okay, like, okay, I can be a part of this translation. I can be a part of this interpretation. But that was kind of a slippery road for me, a slippery hill for me. And I kind of, you know, tumbled down the hill all the way into nihilism and, you know, possible atheism and all these different things, which that was a hole I had to grab myself out of and pick myself out of. Did you experience anything like that, of a kind of skepticism or?
Oh, absolutely. I would say I still do. I don't know. I could ask you a question. You say you had to pick yourself up out of that. What do you mean by that? Why did you feel the need to do that?
I felt the need to do that because I was perfectly okay intellectually throwing away God. But for some reason, I still felt God, even though I didn't believe in him. I still, you know, heard God in the way I did growing up as a Pentecostal, even though I didn't believe in him. And so I had this tension in me where I was either a psychopath or there's something to this. And so I was chasing those questions and I was just looking for any kind of meaning to life. That's when my like interest in philosophy began, was looking for like some kind of ground to stand on. So I was reading a lot of Leo Tolstoy and all sorts of different existential philosophers and writers. And eventually I found the pragmatist, which really helped give me a vocabulary to use. So that's, you know, that's what I mean by pick myself up. I had to postulate God in order to just live, in order to continue my life in any kind of energetic way. And it's still a struggle, but, you know, that's why I'm exploring these questions with different thinkers and people like you.
Right. Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. Yeah. I, for me, the skepticism of it is, I think I got way more nuanced in my skepticism. I don't think it's ever gone away. I think I've recognized that skepticism itself has its limits. And I think it'd be naive and maybe a little immature to think otherwise. And so there are, as you say, postulates. There are certain things that, you know, we need to exist. And so how do we exist?
Yeah.
Those are choices that we're making along the way. And so that I really moved from a religion of discovery to a religion of creation,
right,
where we're not discovering these foundational, everlasting, eternal truths. We're creating them, co-creating them with God. And again, for me, it's not leave God in the equation, leave God out of the equation. That's a personal choice I have. I think one thing that was hard for me, no, I'd say it helped me, is these belief of, I kept anchoring things on these two pieces of scripture. Let's say God sends rain on the just and the unjust, mm-hmm. and that with God, all things are possible. So what for me in Reformed theology was the sovereignty of God really was a hyper sovereignty of God. And so if there's a hyper sovereignty of God, I realized hyper sovereignty and no sovereignty are pretty much the exact same thing. So if you're mapping all of reality onto God's will, then there's really no distinction between everything being God's will and nothing being God's will. And if you have that hyper sovereignty, and if there is no theological calculus, so to speak, that you can't figure God out.
Yeah,
you can't figure God out. So if you can't figure God out, what's the practical import of postulating all these things? And it led me to the road of where you are. I would call it phenomenological, although I know my phenomenological friends would disagree because I'm oversimplifying and probably, you know, not doing justice to the technical theory. But for me, that's how I think about it, is I'm more interested in the practical experiences that we have in life, not so much the grounding of those. Not that I'm not interested in the grounding of things, but that's not what drives me, is this. And then the pragmatists, you know, that come after that, with, you know, Richard Rorty and a lot of these other folks that have been very helpful. And Simon Critchley also been very helpful from an ethical standpoint. So,
yeah, I wanted to ask you about your philosophical influences. You talk about Kierkegaard a lot, and he has been talked about by scholars as a proto-pragmatist, over in the Nordic countries, and you know, there's a lot of similarity between him and William James, and that's really where like my influence comes from the classics, specifically William James as a pragmatist, and his, you know, his philosophy is very much phenomenological, very much existential, And so I've really latched onto him. He just really speaks to my heart. And because I follow him in his will to believe philosophy, making decisions on the heart is intellectually okay with me, which has been really helpful. But who have been your – I know Kierkegaard has, and maybe you can talk a little bit about him, but is pragmatism an explicit influence on you? I just – that's one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on, just because listening to you on other podcasts, I just hear so many similarities.
Yeah, that's a good – I mean, I think pragmatism has – pragmatism's more of an afterthought. Mm-hmm. And I tend to do this quite a bit where I do my own thinking and then I like cobble – it's almost like – trying to get like IKEA furniture without the instructions. And then I put it together. It takes a long time. It's very painful and it's long and it would be so much easier if I just read the instructions, but for whatever reason, I don't. It's a pragmatism of one of those where like I built this like pretty shoddy system of belief. And then I read the pragmatism. I'm like, oh, well, I could have probably shortcut 5 years of that process there. Right. But no, I mean, my influences would have primarily, but so Kierkegaard is an influence, but I would say, Kierkegaard and I don't agree as much as we used to, but he was definitely the gateway drug, and he was very influential in a certain point of where it was going to be, I either throw the whole thing away, mm-hmm. or I still try to put new wine in old wineskins.
Right.
Either Christianity's, I'm just done with the whole thing. It's untenable. It doesn't make sense to me anymore as a place of authority. I think it does all this harm. Or I have to reinvent it. And mm-hmm. Kierkegaard gave me permission to reinvent.
Yeah.
And that was incredible. I'm forever indebted to Kierkegaard, regardless of how he and I have had disagreements since. Mm. So, and in that way, a gateway, because then it did lead me down the path to the next probably most influential thinker chronologically in my life would have been Jacques Derrida. Mm. So getting heavily into deconstruction, understanding the grammar of things, because if the Bible is the word of God, understanding words and language and communication became very important to me.
Yeah.
So a lot of studying of Jacques Derrida and understanding what are his fundamental assumptions and what is he getting at.
Yeah.
And then through Jacques Derrida, I really probably the most influential chronologically. Now I'm getting older, so it's hard to remember, but I would say probably at that point it would be Gilles Deleuze.
Mm-hmm.
So Deleuze became for the last 7 years, I would say Deleuze became incredibly important for me in how I understand things, which is interesting because he would be completely atheistic and be anti any sort of transcendental experience. But that's okay because, again, I'm coming at it from this phenomenological perspective and this his plane of immanence and the point of philosophy to create concepts and his thousand plateaus, you know, Capitalism and Schizophrenia collection and Logic of Sense, actually, his book Logic of Sense was very helpful and influential for me. It took me probably a few years to just understand what the heck he was talking about.
Yeah, a lot of people are with you in that boat.
He's incredibly dense, but I just am still very drawn to Deleuze because he's not – he for me, there's deconstruction. There is breaking down meta-narratives that have been oppressive and unhelpful. And that's Foucault and that's Deleuze and probably to some extent Marion, Jean-Luc Marion's kind of the neutral version of that, or Vatimo. But then there's this like – Deleuze is just a force of creation. Mm. It's a very positive force and I really gravitated toward that. And through that, Nietzsche came alive for me as well. Deleuze wrote a book on Nietzsche. And – went back and read more Nietzsche and said, I really like this guy. And I would say if we're talking about kind of anchor points that have the planet and then there's moons that orbit, but the planetary ones would be Kierkegaard to Derrida to Deleuze. Mm. And I've been at that place. I think Deleuze would still probably be most influential for me. But I'm amassing more and more satellites there surrounding Deleuze. So.
Yeah. Is Deleuze more constructive than obviously Derrida or, you know?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. He's trying to.
So that's a progression that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. He's trying to postulate a new ontology and creation of concepts and planes of immanence and conceptual personae and really trying to, create a new. What do we do in this vacuum now of ontology?
Right.
He's trying to create an ontology of immanence, which is incredibly difficult to do. So I can just see as you read, he's trying to make crap up that I think makes sense in his head, but it's really hard to articulate when no one's really done it before.
Yeah. Yeah, that's something I just read recently, a book on William James. It's called Submitting to Freedom by Bennett Ramsey. And the thesis is that at the crisis, you know, the crisis of the spirit, or the spiritual crisis of the Gilded Age, as some people call it, you know, at the end of the 19th century, all foundations, all authority structures have pretty much crumbled, and in America specifically, and people kind of, you know, had to frenzy up some kind of answer, some kind of, you know, identity. And so you have this rise of like romanticism and the heroic self and all these different things, when the cultural milieu is just completely, there is no meaning, there is no structure, there is no authority, no ground, no foundations. Ramsey's, you know, thesis, he's talking about, he's trying to give a overall picture of William James's philosophy. And he says he's really, what James is doing is really doing what it sounds like Deleuze is trying to do, which is, how do we act? How do we live? How do we still construct a life, even though there is no meaning, or it's hard to say that there's meaning? Like, it really is something that we have to co-create. You know, God's not going to just choose everything for us. He's not going to make everything for us. He's not going to decide everything for us. We have to, like, co-create meaning, co-create the lives that we're going to live, if there's going to be meaning at all. And so looking at William James as this kind of existential philosopher, and looking at the progression of his philosophy, you know, first he comes out with the principles of psychology, which is very much the heroic Nietzschean self. You know, he's kind of constructing an overman almost, and it's very much like everything is deterministic, but we decide what we want to decide, and, you know, anything that's going to happen is going to come from us. And then you see him move more closely to a more mystic self, his varieties of religious experience. And so he's now opening himself to the possibility of unknown, unseen forces controlling life, and a kind of letting go of control, and a kind of submitting to and respecting and being responsible to the forces that be, that control our lives, that are the contingencies of life. And as we move into his, like, pragmatism, his radical empiricism, we start to see him actually construct, like, oh, okay, this is actually possible. And so that's something that I can it's something that I'm very interested in, and I definitely want to check out Deleuze to see how he works these issues out. But there's a lot of similarities between the pragmatists and what they're dealing with, because they kind of looked at the crisis of the Gilded Age head on, and they were kind of like the proto postmodernists, who are like, everything is crumbling, and we need to figure out how to do this. You seem really interested in postmodernism. Is that something that you can comment on?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be as familiar with William James. I appreciate the practical nature of, from what I have read. I've just picked up Varieties of Religious Experience like 4 months ago. I definitely would be interested in that post-structural. That's when, for me, for philosophy gets really interesting, is in that post-structural part. Mm-hmm. I think there would be. I'm definitely interested in that conversation.
It's so similar to like what you and I were just talking about with our, and so many people that you and I know, people that grew up in Christianity and are pretty much going through, like, we are in our lifetimes experiencing what America has been experiencing for the last 150 years, where there's the crisis of foundations and authorities and structures and the building up of meaning. And so it's like, are we going to do that by ignoring reality and just holding on to, you know, made up structures, or are we going to, you know, carry our burdens with us in some kind of responsible way?
Yeah. Can I ask you this? This is a question for you. Maybe you'd have a good answer for it. How, in your mind, does the mission or the enterprise of science fit into a post-structuralist identity, where we're starting to, there is no foundation, there's all these meta-narratives, to the point that I feel like some post-modernity can get absurd in that, you know, every science is really just another meta-narrative, every scientist is just bringing their bias and agenda to the mm-hmm. table, skewing the kind of the practical output that they're getting. Mm-hmm. I'd be curious if you've done any thinking on that.
Well, as far as like the, like, I'm certainly not an objectivist or a metaphysical realist, and so, like, the project of science is not as we hear it, you know, from, like, scientists themselves. I follow Thomas Kuhn, his basic premise on the fact that, you know, there's better languages of, like, paradigms, that fit for our time that didn't fit for later. It doesn't mean that like older paradigms are like less true. It's just that we gain new paradigms, and so we understand things in the world in different ways. But I also, you know, I'm a sort of pragmatic realist where I still think that whatever truth means and whatever objectivity and reality means, I think that we actually can access it. I am not a some kind of like – I'm not a skeptic, you know, and that's something that the pragmatists have helped me work through is like, you know, this doubt everything Cartesianism. Like I don't follow that. I think that we actually can get better at things. I'm kind of an optimist in that way. And that's actually something that I wanted to talk to you about if we had time. Like you talk about truth and facts and like different kinds of truth in relation to the Bible, which we can get to. But, you know, from a philosophical standpoint, looking at logic, looking at analytical philosophy, like we haven't even concluded like what truth is and how we actually know it. And so to talk about like the Bible being true, it's like, look, we don't even know what truth is. So before like we can talk about the Bible being true, it's like we really gotta you know, figure that out, which, you know, people like Rorty, you mentioned Richard Rorty, he looks at analytic philosophy as a failure for that exact thing, and which led him more to more towards like postmodernists, following like Derrida and like different kind of deconstructive, you know, his radical pragmatism kind of led him that way, like the failure to know what truth even is. But I do think that we get better at things. I do think that we progress in things. And so like I am actually optimistic about like the scientific enterprise. I listen to people like Foucault. I listen to the people talking about meta-narratives and the people that are skeptical about it, but I just don't think that's helpful. I think it's unpragmatic to not see the good in it. I do understand that like our ways of looking at the world influence the way we do science. Like I definitely reconnect the value and fact dichotomy. I bring them together. Like it's just, to me, it seems obvious now that like our values influence the way that we interpret facts and stuff. So science is always going to be littered with humanity. You know, that's a huge point that William James makes, that the trail of the human serpent is over everything. And like, and I agree with that. But I think that people go too far in saying that it's all a meta-narrative, there is no science, you know, that there's nothing to hang our hat on. So I'm more optimistic about it. But yeah, those are just some thoughts. I don't have a specific answer to that, but I follow Thomas Kuhn and his, you know, theory of science, and some other philosophers, Eberhard Hermann, who is a Swedish pragmatist philosopher of science and religion, and some of his ideas, which would take too long to get into. But yeah, those are some ideas. I'm an optimistic person about science. I love science, and so like I'm always reading these philosophers who are always like tearing science down, and I'm just like, look, I grew up in a culture, you know, going back to my upbringing, who did not like science, and science was what brought me into the world of like philosophy and naturalism and all these different things. So it's like I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater after I just like you know, made it over to the other side. So
well, that is that. I mean, I do think that in some ways that that's where the fundamentalism or even the foundationalism can creep in, even within like an analytic philosophy. I know not so much anymore, but it's sort of just this incessant need to get to the bottom of things.
Yeah.
And then it's like, well, what happens if there is no bottom of things? And we go on this. There's more practical work to be done where we made this assumption that we need a bottom of things. Mm-hmm. And so I feel that's what I appreciate about science is it's sort of making – it's not interested in what's at the bottom of things necessarily. It's interested in how do we move forward and try to understand the universe in a particular way. Mm-hmm. There's a particular program here. It's not just going down that rabbit trail for as far as we can go.
Yeah.
And so I think there – yeah, I appreciate that. And lately I've been thinking more about truth as process. And understanding the scientific project as one of process, right? So it's Simon Blackburn in his book on truth helped me. It's so hard because I would say I even fall into that camp where I just am like, yeah, I get it. You want to get to the practical stuff and I like pragmatism, but I also have this, I've been trained in the need to like, but you're starting mid-sentence, like you're starting in the middle and then you're moving forward. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to divest yourself of that need to like, okay, but what are you basing that off of?
Yeah.
And sometimes it's not actually a helpful question.
Yeah. I mean, I still, I think that scientists obviously, like, scientists as individuals obviously have a metaphysics, like, a personal metaphysics that's going to influence the way they do science. And I think that whatever truth is in actuality, I think it is at least a regulative concept where, like, absolute truth is something that we strive for, and it keeps us acting and moving forward. And foundations, metaphysics can act as kind of like regulative, like, ideals that keeps us moving forward. I think that there's obviously a world out there that is independent of us, that is, you know, that the all of the accumulated successes of science prove that there's something out there that our ideas are about. Otherwise, they wouldn't be successful, you know, and maybe that's just my pragmatism, but it's also, you know, common sense realism, which, you know, I don't agree with. But, you know, the idea that, like, you have all these things actually working, all of our ideas actually, you know, all our predictions actually coming true and being successful. So obviously there's something there. So the temptation is to make that the foundation. The temptation is to make, like, physical reality and natural reality, material reality, the foundation. But then in certain areas of inquiry, those foundations break down. You know, you start going into physics and it starts to break down. And so, like, no matter what we want to make absolute, we continue down the trail long enough and our principles, our formulas start to break down. And so it's like, okay, like, basing our inquiry on this foundation took us so far until that foundation started to fall apart. So it's almost like, you know, some people have talked about the belief in God is what led to atheism eventually, like the idea of truth and the idea of what's really there and all this stuff eventually led to our secular age. I think that's Charles Taylor in his premise or his thesis. And so, like, there is a really interesting concept that I'm really interested in, the idea of making something absolute until it falls apart, where it's like you base your entire inquiry in science on this foundation, around this principle, until the very foundation that led the inquiry and your methods and practices actually made the initial thing crumble. I think there's something really interesting and paradoxical about that in our human life that we actually live. So back to the Bible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's really where my, like, struggles have come from, like, relating back to the Bible. I haven't made reading my Bible a devotional everyday thing for probably 3 or 4 years. And it's just this kind of stuff where it's like, I don't even have answers to all these things. How am I supposed to approach this book that I still believe to be living and breathing? How am I supposed to approach this thing when I can't even know what I'm talking about about truth itself or what's real and all these different things? So it's like, it makes talking about Bible and what it means for the Bible to be true or real or factual or literal, it makes those questions seem pale in comparison.
Yeah, I mean, I think what helps me is thinking about the language game of it, mm-hmm. That it's giving us language to certain experiences and for a certain community. And that's deeply meaningful inherently in that community. And that's important. And it's not just that. I think we have a tendency to use the word just there.
Yeah.
It's just a language game. Well, that's what we all have, our language games. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we dupe ourselves when we think somehow our American capitalistic language game is somehow better or it's more ethically better in some way. And so that doesn't negate, we have to take different language games to the Bible and critique them. It can't just be this silo. Mm-hmm. But it's that hermeneutical spiral where we're constantly going in and out of the different language games. And I think there is something very valuable about the Bible in the way that it can help create meaning, as long as we curb the tendencies that it can have to lead us into some ethically precarious situations.
Yeah.
And so that's how I see the Bible. And I think it's very valuable. And I appreciate it. It's my language game. It's what I grew up with. And I was a conscious decision at some point to say, like, yeah, you could be a non-Christian. Okay. And now you start over with a different language. And some people, they do that. They appreciate that. I'm much more interested in reinvigorating and embodying in a new expression these sets of concepts and ideas and language that we've inherited. And I think that's what the task of theology is. And I think that's how language works. And I don't think that's anything different than what generations before us has done.
Yeah, I get asked a lot why why I held on to Christianity at all. Why didn't I just become, you know, a secularist pragmatist? You know, I have a series on this show with a few friends of mine. Both are atheists. One's a relativist. One's very much like a realist, you know, objectivist kind of guy. And he asked me, he's like, well, everything you're saying makes so much sense, and I would love it if other Christians would be more like you. He's very much in like the new atheist kind of, you know, group. And he's like, but why, you know, he's like, I feel like you can just drop the Christian part altogether. And exactly what you were just saying is what I've, you know, said to others, which is I just find so much more value for me personally in carrying that upbringing with me, carrying that language game, carrying that tradition, because there's something about it. I mean, it's the same kind of value in marriage where you are committed to this person that you can't just throw away anytime you guys get in a fight or disagree. You actually have to work through it. And there's something in that kind of commitment that makes you both better people, because you have to learn, how do I carry this fight with us? How do I carry this difference with me and work through it and stuff? And you actually have to change. And that's what I appreciate about the Bible and about traditions in general, but specifically the Christian tradition, is that it forces you to transform if you don't let it go. And it doesn't mean that you go back to your fundamentalist ways. It means that you actually have to change and grow in some way. And I'm really interested in that kind of process, you know, going back to process and development.
Exactly. Yeah. I appreciate it. You know, Brueggemann, in his book, I think Text Under Negotiation, has this metaphor of the Bible as compost, as a compost pile. And I really appreciate that, because I think that's exactly right, that it's this dead material that so much life can come from, mm-hmm. if we plant what we need to plant in that. But if we're just looking at it and hoping it to do something, we're asking it to do something it's just not intended to do. It can't do for us. Mm-hmm. And so I appreciate that metaphor of the compost pile. And I use that quite often for what is the Bible? It's a compost pile. And yeah. And I think it's that merging of horizons to, again, misuse lots of philosophers to kind of fit into my own idiosyncratic philosophy. But, you know, Gadamer on this merging of horizons idea, I appreciate that merging of horizons. I there's so much growth in the conversation, but a conversation has two sides.
Yeah.
If the Bible overwhelms my own input, then it's not a conversation. And I've just become a kind of a slave that doesn't grow. I'm just being told what to do.
Right.
But if it's just me, I'm also not being challenged. And that's also where the community of faith and the Bible are great. You know, iron sharpens iron. It's a great kind of sharpening stone, a whetstone for me. Because mm-hmm. if it's just me and Jesus, or me and the Bible, or just me because I'm a solipsist, or because I'm an atheist, or whatever, somehow any belief system that just excuses me from growing in community and developing, not recognizing that people are social animals, I think just does us – it's dangerous, mm-hmm. frankly, from an ethical standpoint. Yeah. But I think it does us a disservice. Those of us who want to grow, I think other people, meaning the Bible conveying the ideas of other people or physically other people, are just really important to growth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was just thinking about that book I told you about earlier by Bennett Ramsey, Submitting to Freedom, about William James. He talks about William James's, you know, what he was working out was a vision of human identity, or like what kind of self is the human self. And what he ends up concluding is that William James's mature self is the religiously bounded self. And what he meant by that was, again, like being respectful of the contingencies, the forces that be in the world that, you know, really determine much of our life, and being responsible to them. And that idea of responsibility is really the religious or mystical side of the self that I am trying to grow and develop in my own life, the idea of responsibility. And that's really why I hold on to the Christian identity, because I feel responsible to that which created me. I feel responsible to, you know, to the world, to all the forces that made life possible for me. I feel like I can't just reject them out of hand, you know. So there's something to that.
Yeah, it sounds a little bit like Jean-Paul Sartre as well, who was pretty influential. I used to teach Jean-Paul Sartre when I taught philosophy at a university, and I really appreciated that, because it was similar, this responsibility. Mm-hmm. The responsibility that comes with freedom, and you call it religiously bound, you know, in Sartre's words. I think it's Sartre. I don't think that's Tillich. I think it's Sartre, that kind of facticity and transcendence. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, you know, lately, so much for me of life comes down to, it sounds so cliche, and I think of this thing that my mom used to have on our counter above the kitchen sink that just had the serenity prayer. But I'm just like, that facticity transcendence. What are we in control of? What are we not? Like, that serenity prayer is just so, it's so profound. I hate that we've made it like so kitschy, and I can just go, you know, buy it at like a convenience store on a keychain or something. But I think it's really, I think it's really profound. I think there's something about that, the wise life, growth in how do we accept that. This goes back to, in a lot of ways, to the philosophy of what's the philosophy of Epictetus and Marcus Aurelius?
Stoicism.
Stoicism. Right. I think that's a lot of what they were trying to figure out is what are those things that emotionally we can detach from because we have no control over them, and how can we take that energy and put it full force in the things that we do have control over? I think that's a good, it's a good ethical starting place. And yeah, so I think that ties somehow to, I don't know how, oh, because I was talking about Sartre. Because Sartre also talks about this authenticity and freedom and responsibility and, and talks about the weight of that and how, and there's something to that. I know a lot of Christians who just can't bear the weight of that. That's it's a terrible freedom. It's a terrifying responsibility to be now wholly responsible for yourself, even though there's all these factors in your life that are facticity, that are unchangeable. And yet I'm still supposed to navigate this and be fully responsible. It's hard. It makes me want to run back to the faith of my youth for
Me all the time. I joke about that all the time with my friends, and they're all like, every time they're like, no, you don't really mean that. I'm like, I kind of do. I'm like, the responsibility of being a self, you know, with free decisions is like almost unbearable. And I mean, obviously there's so many factors that are involved in people staying in, you know, the faith of their youth or their fundamentalisms. Do you think that that is one of the main reasons, if not the main reason, why people stay where they're at?
I think some of it, I mean, I probably would say the main reason I've experienced is more of the social pressure. I think it's a very, unless you have no choice, why would anyone be excommunicated or put tension or hurt? I mean, in some ways it's hurtful, right? I have kids whose, it would be so hurtful to their parents if they came and said, not even just, I want to do away with Christianity as a whole, even just to kind of switch to a different brand of Christianity can get you very lonely. I mean, I used to have lots of the, I'd call them like my midnight meetings when I was a pastor, of people who would say like, I think I'm okay with gay people in the church. And I kind of like, okay, why are we meeting? Well, because if I share that with my mom or my wife or my, you know, whatever, or at the church, I'm going to lose everything. And I learned not to be flippant about that. I think it's really easy to say, oh, but you have to stand up for what you believe. And of course this is true. Like, no, it's way more complicated than that. So if you need to stay kind of quote in the closet for a while on your changing beliefs, as you work through the social implications of all of this, I will not judge you. And I think that's a very wise and mature response. But I would say that social, I think the social implications are probably what people keep, you know, I forget, was it Upton Sinclair who says something like, you know, people are really good at not understanding things. What is it? Whenever they're like, their paycheck depends on them not understanding it, right? People are good. Like, willful ignorance is easy when I have all these pressures not to accept these things. I mean, there's just so much at stake. So I think that's more of it than I think, I don't think people would really fully be, most people I know wouldn't be able to articulate the terrible freedom of the weight of responsibility for self. Those are concepts that would be way over people's heads generally. Only the nerdiest among us.
Unfortunately. Is that something that you've encountered a lot, those kind of encounters with either young people or anybody as a pastor coming up and talking about those kind of themes? I mean, obviously you guys talk about that on your podcast, The Bible for Normal People, often. Is that something that people have been increasingly coming to you with?
Oh, in terms of these, the social piece of it?
Changing your, you know, your beliefs and
stuff. Absolutely. That's, again, that's where my pastoral heart still is being able to talk to those people and say, I know it's tough to feel like you have to choose between your community and your authentic self. Who wants to make that choice?
No one. How do you walk with someone through something like that?
Well, you know, I remember, I think it was a gin hat maker who talked about, you know, it's basically being sent into exile and realizing you think you're going to be sent to exile and there's going to be no one there.
Yeah.
And then you realize it's basically like, what's that? Man, this would have been a better anecdote if I could remember the name. What's the big festival out in the middle of the desert? Burning Man.
Burning Man.
Yeah, so you think it's you're going to go out there and you're going to die of thirst in a day or two, and you go out and you realize it's
Burning Man.
Yeah, it's like a big party out here. Yeah. Oh man, okay. So, but getting people to see that, people have a hard time seeing that because for them, we always want to look at our past, and I, you know, there is some parallel there on the people of Israel, right? When you're getting close, you're out in the middle of the desert. It's very painful, and you look back, and some people grumble and say, "Man, it was better back in Egypt." Mm-hmm. Why? Because it was familiar. Yeah, sure, the people didn't accept me for who I was, and they didn't allow for this, and I was going through a lot of this anxiety. But man, this loneliness is tough, or even the idea of this loneliness.
Yeah.
And so walking with people can sometimes just be being a friend until they meet other friends who, or introducing them to other people so that they say, oh my gosh, I'm not alone. And yeah, I may still be going to hell because that's kind of what's been implanted in my brain. But at least if I'm going to hell, I have a lot of other people who are going to be in hell with me. It just feels less scary.
Yeah.
So yeah, being a friend and not underestimating the power of just listening to people and introducing the other people who are at the same place or who are ahead of them on the journey, it can be really powerful. And sometimes we make the mistake, I think, of like, we want to, for me, this is why I learned a long time ago, you can over-intellectualize it, right? Well, let me just walk you through why you're going to be okay.
Yeah.
People don't know that.
Right.
That's not what they're really saying. They may say that that's what they're saying. But the reality is they just don't want to feel alone.
Mm-hmm.
They want to have someone tell them it's going to be okay, that this is an okay journey to be on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can relate to that a lot. And staying on the desert idea, if, you know, honestly, if I knew where I would be today back when I was making, you know, the decisions to walk away from, you know, those communities and specific language game communities, like, I don't know if I would have done it because I thought that being able to find a new community, I was a little over optimistic about, you know, because I started listening to podcasts and I was like, oh, there's so many other people who are just like me. I can just like, you know, throw all this away and find, you know, a whole group of people just like me. And in real life, it's not that easy. You can find people online, but you can't find real people in your city, in your community, who you can actually latch onto the way you're talking about with Burning Man. So, you know, do you have thoughts on people who are struggling just like me, who, you know, who struggle with that, who can't find a real community to go to other than like online? That, you know, it's a lot easier online communities, but finding real human flesh and bone and blood, like to connect with and not be alone. Like, how do you walk people through that as a pastor? Other than say, hey, come to my church.
Right. Well, yeah, I don't have a church now, so that wouldn't work very well. But I mean, my church, I would invite the church I do attend. I would invite people there. I think of it's very practical for me. There's a few groups that I really trust. I trust gay Christians more. So I try to find affirming churches and point people there. Say, this is probably a safe place for you to be.
That's really smart. I didn't think that. I would think about that.
Basically, gay affirming churches and Unitarian Universalist congregations would be the two places I usually point people to at least find a kindred spirit. And you never know. Some Unitarian Universalist churches, all that to say, you can find fundamentalists on the progressive side as well.
Yeah.
So it's not a guarantee, but I think there's, again, a chance for that. So those would be my two recommendations.
Mm. Yeah, that is very practical. Staying on the idea of there's fundamentalists on every side, is that something that you have been noticing lately? I'll just say right off the bat that I have the idea of rising fundamentalisms on the progressive side of things, especially on Twitter.
Yeah, it's a challenge for sure. I don't know what to do with that. I don't think I have probably much to say. I think it's probably time for me to be quiet on that because I'm Native American. I'm Choctaw. So, but I'm very much white passing. There's a lot of trauma and a lot of persecution in my family's history for sure. But then again, like I haven't experienced that as much directly. I'm sure generationally. So who am I to say I don't know if it's my job to determine what the line of fundamentalism is on the progressive side.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's my place to do it. I can say, I can speak for myself and say, I feel this is unfair when X happens to me, or yeah. I feel this is taking it to, or this hurts my feelings when I get pushback on this thing. Mm-hmm. I think speaking from my own experience is worthwhile, but I don't think it's my place to police that mm-hmm. overall.
Yeah, well, we can move on from that topic. you went to school for, I think I heard you originally were going to college for mathematics. Is that right?
And then I made it for about a semester and then flipped over to philosophy. Yeah.
And then theology and then biblical studies.
Yeah, my undergrad's in philosophy and then my master's is in biblical studies. Yeah. And then I started a THM that I eventually quit because I realized, man, that is not my personality. Yeah. So.
Why is that?
The idea of writing. So I made a very conscious decision. I remember sitting here. My wife went away to Phoenix for a month, where she's from. She took our kids, and said, basically, you got a month. Either you finish this thing, or let's just agree that you quit.
Yeah.
Because I had been hemming and hawing about the whole thing, and in that month, I worked on it a lot. I mean, I was probably 70-80% done with my THM, which could have went right into a PhD, mm-hmm. and. I thought I can either put all this time and energy into something that my committee, you know, dissertation committee or whatever is going to read over and approve, and it's going to get bound and it's going to be put on a shelf and five people are going to look at it for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
I could put that same time. I said, what do I really want to do? Why would I even try to do this?
Yeah.
And the real reason was I want to write and teach.
Yeah.
That's what I want to do. So I came up with a different strategy. Mm-hmm. And I just worked that strategy, and now I've, you know, I think that would have been 10 years ago, more than 10 years ago. And I've been able to teach and write. And so it worked out. But it took some soul searching because I had been affirmed for my, I'm a fan of the Enneagram. So I think of it as like, I'd been affirmed in my fiveness for so long that it really took a hit. My ego took a hit at that point because I was like, well, all these people are expecting me to be super smart and finish this degree.
Right.
And it was very helpful for my wife who when she came back, I told her and she said, I've never been more proud of you. You've never quit anything in your life. And so it was such an ironic thing because most times I think spouses probably are saying the opposite.
Yeah.
She said, but you tend to just do it and do it to the detriment of your own health and your own well-being, and you just get it done and you're quitting something, and I think it's the right thing to do, and I'm proud of you for that. So that was helpful. Yeah,
I had the opposite experience where I grew up always quitting everything or never finishing or starting things, and then in college, you know, I came in a fundamentalist and halfway through became an atheist, and I was like, I need to finish this just to say I finished something this big. So I had the exact opposite experience where I'm like, I had to just finish this thing so I can say I did. Anyways, so you didn't go into like academic scholarship or anything like that. You went into pastorship, right?
Yeah, I mean, I was a pastor all throughout that time. But then I'd been writing curriculum for university. I'd been writing all their master's level curriculum in hermeneutics and pastoral studies. I don't think they knew how young I was. I was probably 23 at the time.
Yeah.
But I was writing these, you know, lots of curriculum at that master's level for them. And that was the other ego thing, is like, I just had to be secure. Like, I'm a pretty smart guy. I can hang in the academic world. I don't need to spend 5 years and like $80,000 to prove that. Yeah. And through a lot of wonderful circumstances, I ended up being able to teach at a university as a professor in philosophy and in ethics and in biblical studies. And I did that for a number of years. And then I went in and I sat down with my dean and I said, listen, I had started a business at the time as well. So I started two or three companies now. And I said, listen, I have this company I'm teaching. I got to choose one. It's getting to be too much.
Yeah.
And I said, what are the chances I'll ever be kind of a full professor here? She said, well, you know, Jared, you got to get a PhD and you got to do that pretty soon. So it kind of came back again to that same thing. Is this really what I want to do? And I decided no. So I did, you know, went with the company and ended up starting a school in Chicago, and it was a business school. And I don't regret that at all, I don't think.
And so now you're primarily a business advisor and working with businesses?
Yeah, that's what I spend my days doing. All family businesses, 100% family-owned companies, working with the relational side of that as well as the strategic and kind of transition planning side. Mm.
And you mentioned that you're writing a book. What's that on?
Yeah, it's on I'm not even going to give you the title now because I'm sure the publisher will change it later. But the whole premise is it's really on this battle between truth and love.
Yeah.
That Christians have, like, telling the truth in love is a phrase that I cannot stand because it's used as a weapon so much.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to undermine that and talk about there's these deep-seated priorities that we've given to truth as a culture. That's not just in Christianity. And I'm just questioning, why do we prioritize truth over love?
Yeah.
Why do we not prioritize love over truth? And yeah, so that's the question I'm going through and using a lot of 1 John, because, man, John talks a lot about love. And he has some pretty provocative things if you just slow down and kind of read what he's actually saying in those passages. And so I'm, you know, turning some of these passages on their head, like, you know, telling the truth in love. Well, that means if you're not in love, you're not telling the truth.
Yeah.
And freedom makes its way in there as well. But yeah, it's really about love and how we've made truth an idol.
Yeah.
And I think it's because we can use it easily as a weapon, because knowledge is power, little Francis Bacon, and so on and so forth. And how I think the Christian narrative, it can be said, is one of upending that and prioritizing love, which is a scary, less boundaried way of living. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the reasons we don't particularly like to prioritize it.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been meditating on that. On a very similar idea on love, pretty much what you just, you know, were talking about for years. And that really was one of the things that really pushed me progressively away from, like, my more fundamentalist belief systems, was that concept of love and how we treat the other, how we treat gay people and treat people that aren't like us, treat Muslims and people that don't believe the same way. And, you know, the metaphor in the Bible, all throughout the Bible, is, you know, familial. I mean, not all of the metaphors for God, but it, you know, the main one is God the Father. Jesus talks about God as Father, and so you have this parental metaphor for who God is and God's love. And so, like, the metaphor only works if we actually apply it, you know, to what we understand about that metaphor, you know, a parent's love. And so when I think about, you know, a parent's love, like, it's all about preparing the child for life as an adult and letting go and letting them, you know, loving them for who they are. Even if it is completely different. I mean, if you look at the actual circumstances, like, kids are always breaking away from, you know, the belief systems and the cultures of their parents. That's like, it's almost built into our psychology at this point as an archetype. And so you have this idea of, you know, of what love looks like from a parent perspective. But then when we talk about it as Christians, the way that you were just talking about it, you know, like, well, if I want to tell truth to this person, I have to basically make sure that I love them. Okay, I'm not going to, like, you can still be a jerk as long as you say that you love the person. It's like, we redefine love and that whole metaphor as, I love you and I care about the outcome of your life and soul, so I'm going to pretty much be a jerk to you and not accept you for who you are. And so it's just a complete disconnect. Is that basically what you're talking about?
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. It is that. It's a little nuanced. And so it's hard to really articulate in a way that I think average people can grasp. But yeah, it's a lot of love is about trusting the other person. Mm-hmm. It's their life, and I have to respect that.
Yeah.
Even if the choices that they're making aren't good for them, and even if they, you know, they're never going to listen to me about any of that or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And it's little practical things, like, I'm just telling you the truth in love. Like, who goes up to, like, strangers and tells them the truth in love? Like, it just makes no sense. Like, what do you mean you love this person? Like, you see a gay couple, you know, walking down the street, and you go, like, harass them. And it's like, well, I'm just telling the truth in love. Like, in what sense do you love this person that you don't know, you've never met? And so, you know, yeah, and there's a point at which in the book I'm working through what do we mean in the Bible by love anyway. And so I think it's really important, because we can't talk about truth and love without defining what we mean by these, which of course is, like, talk about the things that are really hard to define. Yeah. So I know I'm biting off a lot, but yeah. So, you know, defining truth in these, it's going to be an over caricature and over generalized way, but truth is fact and truth is meaning and truth is wisdom and embodiment of a wise life kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then the love side, talking about it being sustainable but yet self-sacrificing. So I like the juxtaposition there, because self-sacrificing doesn't mean you sacrifice yourself into oblivion. Yeah. It has to be sustainable or there is no love yet to give.
Right.
And freedom affirming. Right? So it's always affirming the freedom of the other.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited to see where that goes, and I'm excited to read it, and I will definitely direct other people to it. Going back to, you know, what you're talking about, truth as fact, as meaning, as embodied wisdom, you mentioned that in a podcast, on your guys' podcast, you and Pete Enns, the Bible for Normal People. You talk about the truth of the Bible being, you know, different paradigms, truth as fact, truth as meaning, truth as embodied wisdom. Can you talk about what those three things are?
Yeah, certainly. I've been thinking about this for a while. Is how do we break this idea of truth? Because you can get into you can get into the thick of it, like you said. Like, we don't even know what truth is. But this rabbit hole goes down forever. You can read Davidson and all these folks on truth, and you're like, I don't think anyone has any idea what we're talking about. Which is so fascinating, because it seems like such a foundational thing.
Yeah, like we just take it for granted.
Just thinking about, you know, how the Bible is used. I'm thinking again a little bit more pragmatically. Like, how do we use truths?
Yeah.
When we say something's true, what are we practically in our language trying to communicate? And I think we're trying to communicate facts, natural observations about the real world. We're trying to talk about meaning, which is more of an interpersonal things that resonate with me about how I can interact in the world better and with others. Meaning is always a two-way street, right? I call facts what's true if everybody were dead.
Yeah.
So facts are what's true if everybody were dead. Meaning inherently includes a human element to it. And embodied wisdom includes this embodiment element to it. So that's the natural progression, sort of facts are brute facts, natural observations about the world, and then meaning is inherently relational, and then embodiment. How do we live this out? So it's again, it's an overgeneralization, but I do think it helps as a framework for how we understand the Bible. And saying, okay, first of all, let's parse out what we mean by truth. Are we talking about facts here? Now, the Bible can be right about facts or it can be wrong about facts, but at least we know what we're talking about.
Yeah.
And then meaning, now we can talk about, okay, well, there's two different really kinds of meaning. Are we talking about authorial intent? What did the author intend to mean? And then we can talk about what it means to me. And I don't think either one of those, you know, we can talk about authorial intent as right or wrong. We can't really talk about what it means to me as right or wrong.
Yeah.
It becomes an aesthetic or an art, the two-way street. It's a communication. It's a conversation. And so if you say, is the Bible true? I want to try to break it down into those categories and say, well, let's see. Let's start with facts. Is the Bible true? Yes, there are some facts in the Bible that are true. And no, there are some facts in the Bible that are not true. Mm-hmm. What about meaning? Is the meaning of the Bible true? Well, what did the author intend? We can talk about that. We can talk about what it means to me. And then there's this embodiment. And that's where the book really – so that's what the book I wanted to write, to be honest.
Yeah.
And then the publishers are like – well, the people I've talked to are like, well, that's not a very popular book. Do you want to like write a popular book or do you want to write that book? like, all right, fine. I'll write that book later. But because when we get to this embodiment idea, I think that's what actually the Bible privileges.
Yeah.
So when you say, is the Bible true? What I actually want to say is that's a bad question according to the Bible. I think the real question is not is the Bible true? I think the Bible resists answering that question and asks, are you living truly? Yeah. I think it reverses it and makes it an adverb. And so it resists that question. I don't think that's the question the Bible's asking. I don't think the Bible cares at all whether it's true.
Yeah.
I think the Bible cares whether we're living truly. So it's a tool. It's an adverb, you know. And again, it's that compost pile. Mm-hmm. Like that, it's a motivating force now for a community of people to live well.
Yeah.
That's how far how I got it. We'll see how it goes.
That question of truth and how, you know, the different kinds of truth, the fact that there are different kinds of truth, were a motivating factor for me looking into like pragmatism, because I heard that they had some notions on that topic, and that's what, you know, one of the initial things that led me there. And then I found everything else, and I've been stuck with it ever since. But the idea that truth isn't a property or an inherent quality of something or substance of something or an entity, it is a relation. It's something that does something. Truth is active. It's always active. You know, William James talks about truth happening to an idea. Something becomes true. Something's made true. And so that idea of embodied wisdom I like a lot. Jordan Peterson, I don't know if you know much about Jordan Peterson, but he, you know, he talks about himself being a pragmatist and pragmatic truth, and he talks a lot about in his biblical lectures about like interpreting the Bible psychologically or phenomenologically and talking about myths. And he's coming from like a Jungian standpoint, but the idea of like religions and myths being embodied truth, like you're talking about, where it's not about this is what factually happened. It's this is what happened in this story, and you're supposed to respond to it and relate to it by embodying it, by living it out. And like that way of understanding things, and I mean, a lot of people have talked about like that's how ancient peoples like thought about truth to begin with. I haven't looked at the like, you know, the evidence for that, the actual like evidence for like if that's how people thought back then. Of course, there to some extent we can't really know, but that makes a lot of sense to me, and that makes a sense why like the Bible would be written in the way that it is, and that helps out a lot with how we relate to the Bible, how we relate to God. Where the scripture is about living it out. It's about embodying it. It's like, what truths is this speaking that I'm not supposed to just assent to mentally, but that I'm supposed to live out in my life? And the truth of those things would then be in how well do those truths lead to success or lead to, you know, whatever your ideals are, whether it's love, success, health, you know, all these different ideals that we may have. It's like, how close do these truths, these biblical truths, approximate those ideals when you actually live it out? And that's, you know, that's what William James talks about in his varieties of religious experiences. You know, to a certain extent, there is scientific proof for these things. And the fact that if you live them out, they actually lead to success. They actually lead to better workings with the world, better fit. You know, he's a naturalist or a Darwinianist. He, you know, he's all about like adaptation and fitting with your environment. And if the way you live out these biblical truths help you fit to the environment or fit in your world and adapt to it and live it out more successfully, then that is some kind of truth or some kind of mark on the board for the truthfulness of like of the scriptures of the Bible. And that's something that's a very interesting idea for me that helps me like work out my relationship with the Bible, because I got to a point like many, many people who say, I cannot say that the story of Jonah like literally happened. I can't say that, you know, like, or the flood or all these different things. And it's like, well, there is a whole different way of thinking about truth in the way that you're talking about that really helps us, you know, deal with those things. And I feel like not enough people are talking about that yet.
I agree, but I also think we have to make sure that we don't then retroactively do a disrespect to the text. But so
I'm keeping it all in.
So, you know, we have to be careful not to disrespect the text, and that I want to be very careful about that. That's not what when we say, well, the Bible is really about this.
I don't think
that's true.
Yeah.
I don't think that's what the Bible is really about. It was messier than that. So What did the biblical writers think they were doing? I think they were thinking they were doing all of that at the same time, history writing and all that. But, you know, it is telling that all history writing in the ancient world would have been propagandistic. Mm-hmm. And we think of that as propagandistic because we've separated from kind of fact and motivational information. But for them, that is the same. Why would you just record fact? There's no motivating property to that. There's no trajectory. You're just stating a static fact, the truth as if everybody were dead. Yeah. Well, what's the point of that? Mm-hmm. I would just be careful because I think we can be blinded by our own creative input in that process if we just say, oh, I found it now. The Bible's really about this. No, the Bible's not really about this. Mm-hmm. You've done some things that have helped you make sense of it for what you need it to be in your life right now. That's very different.
Yeah, you find a new paradigm or a new language game, a new way of using this information and language for where you are currently at this moment.
Yeah, that's a good way of saying that.
So is there – because it's something that comes up a lot, and so perhaps you have information on this, like – you were saying that the original, the ancient writers were doing all that stuff. They were they had concepts for all those different ways of thinking and stuff. A lot of people talk about like how like truth or fact just didn't mean the way that you and I like talk about it today. So how do we like parse that out or think about that, like the way that they thought versus the way we thought? Because there's a lot of people who talk about like modern Enlightenment thinkers thinking about like historical truth, like with a camera, like recording history. Obviously, you know, ancient people didn't think about things exactly like that, but you're saying it's a little bit more complicated than they were thinking about truth in a completely like embodied way, and we are thinking about it more historical. You're saying it's more messy.
I think so. I mean, I think that they wouldn't have had those categories, and so it's hard to we're going back and putting those categories onto it. It's anachronistic, mm-hmm. and in some ways, the anachronism is disrespectful. So I just want to be aware that it's. Let them be what they were, and that's where the sciences can help us, because it's how did they think about this? And we see all this evidence that they didn't separate history as fact from history as propaganda. They would have been the same thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm more interested in the psychology or the understanding of why is that, and how can that actually still be helpful today, and how is that not helpful today?
Yeah.
So I would want to just start with that. It already has this objectivist assumption there that I would want to question. Yeah. And speaking of that, I think we are talking to come full circle. This is the heart. This is the bread and butter of Kierkegaard.
Yeah.
Right. Truth is subjectivity. This is what we're talking about. Truth as embodiment, and not truth as this objective thing out there, which doesn't do us any good. Mm.
So whether the biblical writers were using that kind of framework, do you think that that is what we should develop more in our lives today as modern people in the specific situation we're in now?
I think that having a more robust understanding of what it means to be human, and that's important, instead of – sometimes I think the scientism narrative can lead us down the road of if we were just all robots, man, would it be a great world. if we were just robots, I feel like we're trying to get that. I mean, that's in business. That's true. Like, we're trying to take emotion out of business, or we're trying to take these things out that I think are just inherent. And it's not that we can take them out, because we're not robots. And I think that's where it gets dangerous, is when we think we're doing that, because we've already positioned that as an ideal, and it hurts our ego if we admit that that's all still there.
Yeah.
But then we go back full circle to the beginning of the conversation, where you have to draw a line somewhere, because you don't want to just say, well, when the scientist is doing it, their humanity is always in the way.
Yeah,
I think that's not helpful either. But yeah, I think it relates to the Bible. Having the idea of, again, this is a conversation. I think that's the easiest way to say it, is anytime I'm having a conversation with someone, the more I understand about them, the better our communication is going to be, the more I'm going to understand what's going on there.
Yeah.
Which also helps me then to differentiate how I am in that conversation. And so the meaning is in the conversation itself. It's not in getting to something. And that's where process, the word process, whether it's in process theology or other types of process, it's sort of weaning us off this purpose-driven linear framework that we've inherited from hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. And that's where I had to be careful, like the idea of meaninglessness or futility, it might be baked into just a linear way of understanding. I mean, as a Native American and coming from a religious tradition that had a thought of time as circular, talk about nihilistic or meaningless, but that's only if you evaluate it from within a linear framework.
Right.
Anyway, how I got up.
Yeah, so it's like there are other paradigms or language games that can live through the issues that we have in a successful or healthy way. But when you are still brought up in another paradigm, looking at that paradigm or that language game, you are bringing certain issues with yourself into it that weren't there to begin with.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of saying that. Yep.
Mm-hmm. While we're coming to the end of our time, you were talking about respecting the Bible, and I really want to reemphasize that, because it's something that people on the more progressive side of things, me as a pragmatist, you know, like, like I can definitely disrespect, you know, scripture or many other different traditions using it for my own, you know, you want to take the good of things and walk and use it, you know, to your benefit, but you want to do it in a respectful way. Can you talk a little bit more about, before we leave, talking about taking the Bible seriously but not literally and connecting it to that respect that you were just talking about?
I think of reading the Bible as a craft. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important. We've democratized the Bible in such a way that I don't think it's helpful. I mean, none of us would go kind of flip through the DSM for a few hours and then go sit in a therapist chair and just start practicing therapy.
Right.
And so I think it's just important that it's a craft. Understanding the biblical text is a craft. I mean, it's learning languages. It's learning biblical Hebrew and Greek.
Yeah.
And I think that's an important prerequisite before making any judgments about these things. So that's been helpful for me, is how do you respect it? You treat it like a craft. Like, don't disrespect craft. And within that, I love the quote from Charlie Parker, who knows if he actually said it or not. But when someone was talking to him about sort of improv and how do you, you know, so good at this as a jazz musician, he says, well, there's really in three steps. You master the music, you master the instrument, and three, you forget all that shit and you just play.
Yeah.
And so I see a lot of people who want to play with the text to fit their morality or their ethics, their progressives or conservatives, whatever, but they haven't done those first two steps.
Yeah.
It's like, no, it's not that you can't do the third step. It's that just don't do it without the first two, because it's disrespectful. You're making a mess of things. Mm-hmm. And you're hurting people in the process here. Mm. So, you know, that's why I love what we do at the Bible for Normal People with folks like John Levinson and Jewish scholars I so respect, because it's in their DNA. It's the water that they swam in their whole life.
Yeah.
You can just tell when you talk to someone who has lived the biblical text for their whole life just the way that they talk, they can just roll these things off their tongue. It's so part of who they are. Mm-hmm. Those are the people I trust to improvise and get creative with how we live this out in the future. Mm-hmm. If you don't have that background and foundation, you just run the risk of making a mess of things and disrespecting what's gone before, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I can appreciate that so much. In my looking into like Derrida's work and deconstruction and, you know, different, specifically Derrida, you know, people think about his work just as deconstruction, just blowing it all up. But a guest of mine, Wilson Garrett, he dabbles, so disrespectful to say, but he looks into like postmodernist philosophers a lot. And he was the one that kind of made me realize that like what Derrida's doing, you know, he mentioned something that I never heard anyone else talk about when it comes to Derrida, which is that you're deconstructing something that you love, something that you're committed to. And that was just such a huge eye-opener to me with Derrida's work that kind of pretty much just opened his entire, you know, work up to me. I was like, oh, okay, I finally get it. Like, it makes sense now. Like, you're not just deconstructing things to be an asshole. You're deconstructing things because you love it and you're committed to it. And like, That is what we need to bring into this conversation with the Bible.
And that's the, you know, for me, that's what was hurt my feelings so much as a kid, was all of these things I was finding was because I was taking it seriously. I mean, Derrida was meticulous. He read these texts over and over, word from word, translating it from the original. I mean, he was meticulous in the text that he was deconstructing. Mm-hmm. And that's where it was hurtful for me, is like, the assumption that the only way you come to these conclusions is because you hate this thing and because you haven't done homework.
Yeah.
It's like, no, I think you can come to these conclusions precisely because you love it and precisely because you have done your homework.
Yeah.
And that's Derrida's whole project, is to say it's inherent in language. So if you look closely enough, it's like physics. Yeah, every day things seem to follow all these rules, but if you looked closely enough, it's way more chaotic than you think. Mm-hmm. And it takes someone who's patient enough and skilled enough to look closely to see the chaos. Mm.
Yeah, well, I think that we can definitely end on there, because I think that that's such a important thing to meditate on. I appreciate you coming on so much. I would love to talk again sometime. I didn't think we were going to get into philosophy so much. So
I hope that was
it. It threw me off. I was like, oh, shoot, what do I have to say about this? But no, I really appreciate you coming on. Can you, is there anywhere people can find you online? You want to plug your podcast or any other works you have, books?
Well, yeah, you can find us at thebiblefornormalpeople.com. That's kind of our group, and it's more of Pete's platform. You can find me on Facebook. I have an author page there, on Twitter, Jay Bias. And yeah, I'd love to connect with people. I have a lot of thoughts I throw out there. So that's probably the best places to find us right now. One of those three places. And again, yeah, the podcast, The Bible for Normal People, we're finishing up season two right now. I don't know when this will air, but season three will be coming out in February of 2019.
Yeah. Well, hopefully you will be open to further conversations, because I learned about you from The Bible for Normal People podcast. And so I did, you know, what I do when I find someone that I like the ideas of. I started Googling you, and there's not enough of you out there. So hopefully I can remedy that, put more of your thoughts out there. I think that a lot of people need to hear more of them. And I'm just butting your bread right now, because I want you to come back on in the future. But I really, really appreciate you coming on. I appreciate a lot of your perspectives, especially taking traditions and the Bible seriously and respecting it. And only when you do that can you then have the right to start to pull things apart and analyze them. I really, really appreciate that. I'm going to be thinking about that for a while. So thank you so much for coming on.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much.